Welcome to The Conscious Podcast, the go-to podcast for law firms looking to elevate their digital marketing strategies. I'm Laura Morris, Social Media Manager at Conscious. In this episode, we're diving into the world of law firm culture with Amy Sawbridge, brand and people strategist and founder of Sawbridge Consulting. We talk about why culture is no longer a nice to have in professional services, how law firms can align brand and values to attract and retain top talent, and what it takes to create meaningful change that's more than just a perks package. Whether you're leading a team or just starting to think about culture strategically, this conversation has something for you. Hi Amy, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Laura. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Not enjoying the heat as much
Oh,
as
you see, I'm loving the heat. And look, it won't last for long, you know that, so
Soon it will be autumn, my favorite time of
I
year.
don't say that.
Not wishing the time away, but so thank you for joining us on the podcast today. We're going to be talking a little bit about your business, Sawbridge Consulting, and how we can kind of build cultures and branding within businesses and how that can help attract and retain talent. So, for listeners who haven't come across your work before, can you just give us a little bit of a background about what led you to focus on brand and people and culture and why that led to starting Sawbridge Consulting?
Yeah, of course. So I started my career in HR, so that's my background. And actually I started working for a small charity based in Bristol. It was a temp job for 2 weeks and I ended up staying for more than 5 years. But it actually, funnily enough, it was a bizarrely relevant bit of experience because it was any kind of charitable organization tends to be very purpose driven, and people that are there feel very aligned to what they're contributing to. And that has kind of continued to be a theme through the work that I do. I guess my big break, if you like, was when I started working for Virgin Mobile, which was a long time ago now, and it was again based in Trowbridge at the time. And that's when I guess I discovered the importance of how you bring a brand to life for your employees. It's not just about your external brand reputation. It is how do you make it really easy for your people to feel it, and represent you effectively externally. And so I ended up spending 10 years working for Virgin. After my stint at Virgin Mobile, I moved to Virgin Group and I worked with all of the Virgin companies globally on anything people and culture. And so basically my remit was, how do we make sure that we've got a really consistent culture across the different Virgin companies, because they were all completely independently operating, but how do we make sure that that culture is progressive and aligned with the Virgin brand so that we are living up to expectations that people had of the brand. And then, I guess since then I've been freelancing now for coming up to 8 years, and predominantly have been focusing again on really focusing on what is different about an organization. Some people refer to it as their purpose. Sometimes people will talk about it as their DNA, what's their kind of core essence. I tend not to get hung up on the terminology, as long as we know it's about your why, your what, and your how. But I feel quite strongly about how you align your purpose with your brand image, your brand representation, and your culture, because your brand speaks to multiple audiences. It's not just the general consumer. So that's my little potted history.
That's good. That's really great. Thank you. So just gonna jump into culture in professional services spaces. So why is corporate culture such a critical topic, and why should law firms in particular, do you think, be paying attention to it right now?
So I think, very bluntly, a business is nothing without its people. And your culture very much determines the type of people you have, the quality of people that you can hire, their desire to work hard for you and to deliver for you, and more importantly, to stay with you, and to advocate for you. You know, we know a lot about now, people are very vocal about their experiences, whether that's as an employee or as a consumer. So ideally, focusing on creating a brilliant culture enables people to feel that they want to advocate for you, they want to be your ambassador. And all of those things long term essentially drive your business success. So it's, for me, it's not a nice fluffy thing. It is very, it's the core of what makes a business successful. And I mean, again, I go back to my Virgin days. You know, Richard Branson very early on recognized that, and he puts it more eloquently than I'm about to, but he recognized that if you have happy employees, you have happy customers, and then you'll have happy shareholders. And so looking after your people by creating a brilliant culture and a brilliant environment is the very best way of having happy employees. And there are some very clear commercial drivers for doing this. You know, you can look at all sorts of, and I mean, I can reel off a load of stats, and I'm not sure that that will engage the audience much, but there are known uplifts in things like time to hire, cost per hire, quality of candidates that you get, all because you've got a strong culture. And then, you know, once people are through the door, you have much higher levels of retention. You know, some organizations quote that they have up to 50% more retention as a result of a great culture, lower levels of absenteeism. You know, and we know, again, if people feel a real sense of affiliation to your business, they will talk about it. And, you know, now, thanks to social media, everybody's got a platform from which they can share their experiences. And, you know, interesting when you start talking about trust in corporate messages, because there's a brilliant stat. An employee message has 561% further reach than corporate messages. And people believe in other people more than they'll believe in a CEO. Like, according to Edelman Trust Barometer, that people will believe an employee three times more than they will a CEO, because sometimes it just makes it that much harder, because it feels like it's too trite, it's too orchestrated, it's too veneered. Whereas if people are listening to their peers, or, you know, people that they just come across on social media, it is much more believable. I mean, I think all of that has stood the test of time for a long time, but now you've got shifts in societal expectations around what a culture should be like, what an employee experience should be like, what, you know, what the deal is between you and your people. And that's, I mean, that's beyond just professional services and law firms. But I think, you know, my sense with a law firm is, and this, you know, excuse my ignorance, but by and large, a lot of the services are the same. So then the thing that you are distinguishing yourself through is your culture, is your people, and therefore how that then shows up to your customers. You know, the nuts and bolts of the service probably remains the same, but that old adage of people buying from people, if you've got the right talent in your organization that are brilliant brand ambassadors for you, that wins your business, it keeps your business, it, you know, word of mouth, referrals, all of that. So I think there is an opportunity for a law firm or any professional services firm, I think, where through certain, like, compliance, you know, and governance requirements, there are lots of standard components to what you offer. It's how you offer it that is the greatest opportunity, I think, to stand out. And whether that's through brand reputation or whether that's through the cultural underpinning of that brand reputation, I think it's something that all businesses should pay attention to, but particularly in a market where there has to be some standardization of offering.
Absolutely. When you were talking about people buying from people, it just spoke to me when we, because obviously I do social media for our clients, and I would say 99% of the time the posts that do the best and reach the most people and get the most engagement are the employee posts, you know, about the business. They're the ones that reach the most people and people respond to the most.
And they feel the most authentic, don't they? And it's interesting. I mean, we haven't got time on this in this conversation. I don't need to go into it too deeply, but there's an increasing rise of companies setting up deliberate programs for employees to be their social media advocates, if you like. And I can understand why they do that, but I think you have to be supremely careful in how that's managed. You probably know more about this than me, Laura, but it's like, if anybody starts to get the remotest whiff of it being engineered, I suspect it will actually probably have the polar opposite effect of the one you want. So it's a really interesting balance around, empowering people so that they feel that they can and they want to, and they want to off their own back. Also, I do understand the need for some consistent messaging, but how you walk that line, I think, is not an easy one for a lot of businesses to navigate. But get it wrong at your peril, because I think it will do more damage than doing nothing at all, actually.
When you were talking about the shift as well in what's happening, do you think that COVID has had an impact on culture and things in businesses?
It massively has. I mean, it's an interesting one, because there are lots of elements that came to the fore with COVID that I think some employees would have already experienced. For example, that the whole remote and hybrid working, there were lots of people who were already working in a very flexible way in terms of location. But it's become much more mainstream, obviously, and particularly, I think it's important just to flag, but it's not relevant for your audience, but over 50% of the UK workforce don't have the flexibility around where they work, because they're not doing the types of jobs, like, they're not knowledge workers. So let's put that to one side. The other sort of, just under 50% of people have experienced a very different way of working now, and actually, for those that were furloughed, I think it probably raised some questions around the role that your job plays in your life and in your identity. It's one of those things that you probably don't spend a huge amount of time thinking about until something like COVID happens and you realize that, yes, you're getting paid 80% to sit of your pay to sit at home and do nothing. Well, what now? Whereas, those of us that carried on working, we still had that sense of purpose, that sense of contribution, that sense of connection, albeit through a screen, which became a bit tedious, obviously. But I think, flexibility is now, it's an expected norm. Balance between your home life and your work life is much more important now for people. I think, there was a realization that life is precious and too short, and why slog your guts out every day for a job, particularly if it's not one that you enjoy or one that you feel recognized and appreciated in. So I think there's definitely been shifts there. I know that, there's a lot of conversation about younger generations placing much more emphasis on working for an organization that is purpose driven. I again, and I st as I said, I started out my working life working for a charity, so that has always existed, but I think it's a stronger pull for people now. And whilst it might be more present in a younger kind of cohort of employees, the reality is the rest of us who are a bit older, we also want to work for an organization that cares about more than just, profit and filling the pockets of the exec team. There is that whole thing around psychological safety, inclusion, well-being, and a lot of these are buzzwords and have been slightly hijacked. And, they've become quite extreme in their meanings. But at the end of the day, it's actually just being good human beings, and it's being kind to each other, and it's recognizing that we all have lives outside of work. And again, there is a sense of a stronger employee voice, although over the last year or so, that is changing back again. I think during COVID, there was a real sense of the dynamic between employer and employee having shifted in the employee's favor. Given that there is a higher level of redundancies happening, particularly in the UK at the moment, I think that might be shifting back a bit. But still, people have long memories, and if they've been badly treated by an employer, they will remember that. They will tell everybody about it. And we, as human beings, will make consumer purchase choices based on brand reputation, whether we've heard about it as an employee or not. So, again, businesses need to be mindful of how they interact with people now, whilst, the pendulum is swung back towards them versus the employees, because it will come full circle. And then, of course, you've got AI, which is, I guess, probably highly relevant for most businesses, but law firms as well. It is changing the employee experience, both in terms of how we interact with our employers, but it's another tool for us to have access to as a knowledge worker, which in theory means that it's leveled a playing field because you can access knowledge that you would normally have only acquired through age and experience. And so there's been an interesting shift already, I think, where those skills and that knowledge has become sort of commoditized. So what are you hiring for? Well, again, hopefully you're hiring for potential, you're hiring for behaviors, you're hiring for that person that's additive to your culture and what your brand stands for, so that you can build those human connections with your clients and what have you. But again, we're only at the very beginning of what AI is going to mean for organizations of all shapes and sizes. We've still got to work that out, but I think it still puts an onus on investing time and energy and understanding what you stand for as a business, as a brand, and how you make sure that that translates through to your culture so that people know what they're buying into, whether that's as a client or as an employee, actually.
So, you discuss on your website the interaction between brand and culture. So, can you just explain a little bit about how these two areas influence one another and what happens when they're out of sync?
So, I mean, at its most basic, I think that brand and culture are just two sides of the same coin. They are both how your business is experienced by different audiences. So, again, I talked about social media, but you can't. I think there was a time, probably many moons ago, where you could carefully craft how your brand was experienced by your customers, and it could be totally different to how your brand was experienced by your employees. But you can't operate like they're separate anymore because everybody's got a megaphone, essentially, haven't they? And so I think, again, making sure that there is that alignment actually just makes life a lot easier because, again, at the end of the day, it's your people who experience your culture, clearly, that are representing your brand. So if your brand and your culture are aligned, it is much easier for them to deliver a brilliant customer experience, deliver a brilliant client experience, and one that is aligned with what the expectations are that have been set. So it's actually just, in my mind, it just makes life easier. It's almost like a shortcut because if your people feel it, then it comes naturally to them and they can deliver on that without having to consult a manual about, well, what do I do in this instance or that instance? So I think, it feels like we create possibly a bigger distinction between the two things than we ought to. But I understand that they are traditionally seen as two different things. And when those things are out of sync, it can show up in any number of ways. An obvious one, and one that I've experienced, is that you end up with higher levels of employee turnover, particularly in their early tenure with you. And this was a challenge that we faced a bit at Virgin, actually. Everybody expected that we would be a certain way because they'd seen the consumer brand and they thought it was all like party 24/7 and red high heels and lipstick, and it's not. Like, we worked really hard and we didn't have particularly big budgets. And what was happening was we had quite a spike in turnover of employees between sort of 6 and 12 months. Now, you can make the data tell you whatever story you want, but for us, we concluded that there was a mismatch between the expectations and the reality. So high turnover at an early point, I think, is often a telltale sign, and it costs the business a huge amount of money. Huge lost productivity, but just the kind of cost of hiring new people. Again, I think it shows up in your client interactions because if you've got the wrong people in your organization, they're not going to be representing you well. And therefore, your client expectations aren't going to be delivered against. And even now, with the rise of, ESG, when clients are looking to find a third party partner to work with, they are going through a huge amount more due diligence in terms of who they're choosing to work with, and they want to make sure that they have got their own credibility when it comes to ESG. being a much more purpose-driven organization, etc. So I think, again, if you get found out if there is this sort of disconnect between what's said on the outside and then what's actually being lived up to on the inside. So I think you do start to see these signs in a multiple, they'll pop out in lots of different places, but I think they all go back to that core issue of there being a misalignment or even just not paying attention to it actually, which I think, a lot of businesses don't do.
Yeah, and I think the retention side of this problem is definitely something that I'm hearing from quite a lot of law firms as well. Like they are really struggling to keep people. So it's definitely, and like you say, it's such an expense to kind of keep going through that recruitment process and to find the right people. So having this in place and having it right at the first time is very important.
It is.
Yeah, in the context of law firms, so they are quite, it is a very the law industry is very compliance driven. There's a lot of legacy, and hierarchy going on. How can leaders begin to align the brand and the culture in an authentic way? As we said before, we don't come across as forced in any way.
I think this is true of all organizations, actually. What I would always advise is that they kind of go back to their roots and they look at what were the kind of founding principles or ethos when a firm was created. Because often with any organization, there was a kernel of thought around how we might do something differently, or there's a wrong that we want to right. So more often than not, there is something at the beginning of a business's existence that was sufficiently compelling for it to have been created. And I think, again, when you think about the world of law, in itself, it's a pretty compelling purpose because it's there to uphold justice, obviously across a whole range of different legal areas. And I know there's a real breadth of types of law and what have you, but actually at the very root of it, irrespective of the particular brand or the particular firm, there is something fundamentally purposeful and good. So if the offering and the services is broadly the same across law firms because of that, it is going back to the roots of, well, what were those founders? What was important to them? What were their values? Why did they decide to do this and believe they could do it in a different way? And why, it's a really simple question, but I think it's a very powerful one, which is, why do customers choose you over somebody else? And it will be, again, we've talked a bit about the relationships that you have or the type of people that work in your organization, but there will be something about the how that adds to the what that I think is actually at the heart of how a law firm or a leader can go about aligning their brand and their culture. And I suspect it will always be there. There'll be these signs of it, these hallmarks of it throughout how they operate now. But sometimes, if you haven't purposefully articulated it, it's just a bit easier to deviate, or it's a bit easier for it to get diluted. And so that might be leading, as you said, to some of the higher levels of turnover in the employee base at the moment. And it's not because it's not there, it's just it's harder kind of to grasp. And so actually, I think being much more explicit about it and much more deliberate about how you bring that brand to life through the day-to-day interactions, it shouldn't be hard work, actually. It should actually make life a lot easier because you've got sort of core essence of what your firm stands for, and you use that as your compass for making the various decisions about how you go about things, how you treat your employees, what are the things that you place at the, really at the heart of what you do. So I think that level of authenticity allows you to make much clearer decisions. It allows you to be honest about who you are as well. I think there's a nervousness a lot of the time that we have to be all things to all people. And I don't believe that to be true. I think there are certain cultures and certain environments that brilliantly suit certain types of people, and then there are others that are much more suitable for other types of people, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think we run the risk of being terribly vanilla and meaning nothing to everyone if we aren't honest with ourselves about what our own kind of cultural attributes are, the type of talent that really thrive in our environment, and be comfortable with the fact that we won't be for everyone. And that's not an excuse for poor behaviour, but it is just, if you're upfront about who you are and what you stand for and how you do things, people can make an informed choice then about whether to be part of your organisation or not, which means they're much more likely to be additive to your culture and therefore your brand and therefore your business, and much more likely then to stay for longer.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. So how can a strong internal culture support a law firm's ability to attract and retain and engage that top talent, especially among the younger professionals? As you were saying before, they're seeking more purpose-driven workplaces.
Yeah, I mean, for me, your culture is absolutely, it's absolutely at the heart of how you do all of that, how you attract, engage and retain. And again, it's this point, it's the right talent for you. It's not just, you know, talent, it is the ones that are going to find their kind of their home, their tribe in your organization. Firstly, having a really clear culture is a great way of standing out in the talent market. So it allows you to differentiate and helps people make that decision about whether they want to join you. And according to Glassdoor, 77% of people will look very closely at an organization's culture when deciding to apply for a job. I mean, actually, I'm surprised that it's only 77%. I'd have sort of thought that most people would look, but you know, that's across all sectors. So who knows? But what I do know is, again, the stats back up that if you've got a really strong culture that is well represented externally, you can fill positions 24% faster. You get 50% more qualified candidates, and you actually end up spending half the amount on recruitment, because let's face it, recruitment is an expensive exercise, particularly if you're going through headhunters. So you want to get it right. And then, you know, once you've got the people, the right people through the door, again, living up to that promise, living up to that brand reputation through a strong culture, it galvanizes their energy. It makes people more inclined to work harder for you. We talk a lot about discretionary effort. And I think, again, through COVID, people are less inclined to do that because they have, you know, it has shifted the balance. But we still want that from our teams. We still want people who will go above and beyond. And they'll only do that if they feel that they are getting some reward in some way, shape or form. And often that reward is actually just feeling a sense of connection and belonging. You know, it drives loyalty in a way that cold, hard cash just doesn't. And that's not to say that pay isn't important. Clearly it is, but it's not the thing that keeps people. So, you know, again, positive cultures have been shown to have much higher levels of engagement and therefore that, you know, much greater discretionary effort. People will work harder for you. They're more likely to stay. And as we've touched on, they're more likely to advocate on your behalf. There's a brilliant stat around employees who are referred from somebody who already worked in your firm, they're 25% more likely to stay long term. So once it's that word of mouth kind of referral network, it's an even stronger hire that you end up making. So I think, you know, there's lots of evidence to suggest that the impacts of a strong culture, you know, work really hard for you across the sort of the whole employee life cycle, really.
Yeah, that stat about the referrals is quite amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to start talking a little bit about Sawbridge Consulting and how you kind of typically work with clients. So
yeah,
what does your approach look like in practice? Can you just kind of talk us through the process a little bit?
Yeah, so the starting point is always lots of questioning and listening, because often I find that a client will come to me with something that they think is the issue, but it's actually a symptom, not the cause.
Yeah.
So often the sort of the start of the process is really getting under the skin of what's going on so that we can create a very clear brief. And again, I feel very strongly about whatever we work on together is always bespoke. It has to fit the requirements of that business. It has to fit the shape and size of that business. So I will spend a bit of time also agreeing with the client. What do they already have in place? What's working well for them? What's not? You can see any number of different models in this world. You've got vision, mission, values, employee value proposition, corporate narrative, brand strategy, and it just becomes noise. So I will always work with a client to get really clear on how do we keep this as simple and as accessible as we can so that it actually does the job it needs to do and we're not disappearing down a rabbit hole creating something that isn't actually going to be effective. So that's always the very starting point. Typically, through that, we'll diagnose that we need to do a bit of work around their DNA or their purpose, just to get really crystal clear on what they stand for, as I said. And that seems really obvious, but lots of businesses think they've got a clear purpose. But actually, if you were to ask 10 people, you'd get 10 different answers. So there is real value in having one articulation of it that is then shared and understood. And I believe the language is really important for that as well. It has to fit the business, it has to be practical. So having one clear message it is not to be underestimated. And if an organization has already got one, which many do, then simply just do a double check that it's right, that it's still relevant, that your people understand it. So we don't always have to start there, but we have to make sure we've got that as the foundation. I will then work with them on how they bring that to life. Now, typically for me, it's for the employee experience. So it's how do we use that kind of DNA, if you like, or purpose, whatever we're calling it, as a set of design principles, that it shapes the decisions that are made in the business. It shapes the employee experience. And again, I don't think that has to be terribly complicated. Once we've got it set up and people understand that it should be influencing your day-to-day interactions, actually makes life a lot easier. I do some work with other clients where I will help them think about how their DNA shows up to their customers or to their other key stakeholders within their organization. But as I said, my background's HR, so predominantly I spend time on kind of how it shows up for your talent. And then the third phase, if you like, is when you can talk about it. So that gets more in, again, into that kind of really delivering on it and demonstrating it with the evidence so that it is backed up by those authentic proof points, rather than just being a nice world of fiction that we're putting out there externally to talk a good game and then people are terribly disappointed when they arrive. So that would always be that sort of final piece around demonstrating is always the sort of the bit that we do once we've got the collateral, if you like, the evidence to talk about it. But and also lots of internal kind of storytelling, because I think when you've gone through the piece of work, and particularly if you're a senior leader as well, you're living and breathing it, hopefully, because you're always on stage. People are always looking for you to you at how as to how you do things and how you role model it. But I think it's easy for the teams on a day-to-day basis sometimes to forget about it. And so there's a big piece of comms internally to again keep pointing out all those stories that are really bringing it to life, where you're evidencing how it's influencing the decisions that you're making, month in, month out, where you celebrate examples of your people living up to those values or that promise or whatever it is for your customers. But that kind of that constant drumbeat of conversation about it. And I think it's easy to worry that people will be bored of hearing you say the same thing over and over again. And in my view, and I'd love your thoughts on this, given what you do, Laura. But my sense is, if it's only at the point that you are sick and tired of hearing yourself say it, that it's probably even remotely registered for the average person, because we're being bombarded by so many messages, it's easy to forget them. And so I think it is the senior leader's job to to be that drumbeat and to repeat, repeat, repeat. You can inject variety and, you know, newness through the stories, but it's always coming back to that repetition of those kind of core values or your core purpose. So
yeah.
I don't think it's an overly complex process, but I do think it eventually, like, it unlocks some real power and some real value. And I the way that I work is always very collaboratively with an organization, because nobody knows the organization better than they do.
Yeah.
I just know some of the shortcuts and the pitfalls on doing this work. But when I will say, well, this feels really distinct in the listening exercises that I've been doing, it's always interesting to hear, you know, what somebody who's been part of the business for 20 years or whatever says about that. So it's always a collaborative effort, but it's hard when you're in it to see the wood for the trees sometimes. And we all get, I mean, I found this after I'd spent 10 years at Virgin before I left, and you've kind of drunk your own Kool-Aid by that point. You know, you're so ingrained in it that sometimes you actually don't see what's special about you as an organization. You take it for granted. And sometimes you have a blind spot about, well, everybody says that actually, you know, every law firm says that they operate with integrity. I mean, that's just table stakes, right? You would hope that you'd actually, frankly, hope any organization operates with integrity. But the number of times that I've seen organizational values with integrity and teamwork and excellence, and you just think,
yeah,
there is nothing distinct about you at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe strongly that there will always be something special and unique about every organization, every culture. And it's part of my job to help tease that out through this process.
Yeah, that must be really satisfying to kind of go into an organization and kind of help them discover that, because
It is, yeah.
You know, like you said, it's probably not that complex, but it's just getting them thinking in the right way, you know, in terms of.
Well, it's taking time out as well.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
We're all kind of running to stand still a lot of the time. So it's not really the sort of thing that you spend a huge amount of time normally reflecting on, but having somebody get, you know, ask you those questions and play it back to you, well, these are the things that have emerged, I think can be really powerful. And there's always a moment in every process I've done where I've had the fear that I'm not going to find anything distinct. Or I'm not going to find anything unifying from all of the conversations and all of the insight gathering process that I've gone through. So there is always that moment. I've yet to feel like 100% confident all the way through, but thankfully I haven't failed yet in finding something that is distinct, which is a relief. And I do believe that. I believe there always will be something. But yeah, there's often a moment where I'm probably about a quarter or a third of the way into the insight gathering, and I'm starting to get nervous.
Oh no.
It makes the satisfaction at the end even stronger, of course. It's tinged with relief.
Exactly, yeah. Now, talking about culture, it kind of can seem, and I know we've talked about it internally at Conscious as well, it's sometimes really hard to measure. It's an intangible thing sometimes, culture. So how do you help clients see and feel the change?
So with a background in HR, I can tell you throughout my 23 plus years, return on investment is a constant question for HR as a profession, let alone culture. So very bluntly, I believe that if your business is performing well, it's because your culture is performing well. I think we spend too much time trying to create a false separation between business metrics and cultural metrics, because I believe they are one and the same. You know, your organization's KPIs are probably the most effective way of measuring whether your culture is working for you, you know, because it will be fundamentally driving your revenue, your profitability, your customer engagement and satisfaction, your brand awareness, your levels of innovation, the cost for customer acquisition, all of that stuff that whatever business you're in will be measuring. That all comes down to the people that are in your business.
Yeah.
and how effectively they are delivering your services and delivering your brand. So my starting point is always they are one and the same. You do not need to make a distinction. However, I've also spent long enough in this world to know that there are times when more granular measures are needed for particular kind of cultural initiatives that you might be undertaking. And I didn't mention, but whilst I was freelancing, I did a chief people officer role for a group of restaurants in the UK, and it was a constant point of discussion with my exec chair. And she was very determined that we could only have one primary measure for culture. Now at Virgin, we had talked a lot about employee net promoter score, which at its simplest is just how likely are your employees to recommend you as a place to work. So that's what we used at Virgin, but my exec chair at the restaurants wasn't up for using that. And to be honest, I understand it. I think the reality is choosing one metric is pretty tough anyway.
Yeah.
But we landed on retention because we figured that if people enjoyed the culture and enjoyed the environment in which they were working, they would stay.
Yeah.
I mean, hospitality is obsessed with employee retention anyway, because it's a really, really challenging industry to work in. But that was, again, as I say, for us, it was the ultimate kind of indicator of whether our culture was working for us. But there are loads, you know, things like internal promotions, the numbers of grievances and disciplinaries that you have, your performance ratings, you know, how well are people doing in their roles, how many absence days people are taking, again, even your engagement survey, albeit, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the efficacy of engagement surveys, but there will be lots of things that you can look at. And I guess my advice to anybody wanting to track the health of their culture is get really clear on what are the key areas that you're looking to see the improvements in, or what were the key initiatives that you've launched, so that you can prioritize your areas of focus, because you can kind of get a bit of data overwhelm, because there will be a huge amount of kind of data points that you can look at. So really, it's what's most material to your organization, to the particular issues you might be facing, or the particular opportunities that you're trying to seize. But there's no shortage of them. But as I said, you know, for me, it all comes back to, well, how well is your business performing overall, as being the most effective measure of whether your culture is working or not.
Yeah, because as you said before, you know, happy employees is happy business, you
yeah
know?
Yeah,
And people will buy from that as well, you know. If your employees are miserable,
oh, massively.
That's gonna feed out, isn't it?
It totally does. It really does. So I think it's not to dodge the question, because I hope that I've answered it with, you know, a number of more granular metrics that you can put in place, but I think as the overall measure, that for me is the most effective.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So have you got any standout success stories or transformations that you've led or you've witnessed that you'd be happy to share with us?
Yeah, I will choose a Virgin one, and I don't mean to keep kind of harking back to it, but, and I know I touched on it a little bit earlier. During my time at Virgin Group, we decided to define we called it our people promise, but it was basically what employees could expect if they became part of Virgin. Again, it was to manage the expectations of what it was like to be within a Virgin brand. And the reason for that was, I think, as I said, we had a really high level of, or a higher level than we would like, of employee turnover within the first 6 to 12 months of service. So and there were other drivers, but we decided that we would go through this piece of work. We'd identify our people promise, which was the first time, I think, when we did this work, Virgin had been in existence for about 45 years and had never articulated this. And at the time, we had about 60 Virgin companies globally. And so, you know, not only was it a brilliant way of managing prospective employees' expectations, it was also a really valuable asset for the businesses to know what they should be delivering on from a culture perspective to our employees. So the two kind of, well, there are three major signifiers for me of the value of this and the impact that it had. One was it was adopted by all of the Virgin companies, and they didn't have to. My role was one of, I described it as chief cat herder. Like, I couldn't force the Virgin companies to do anything they didn't want to do because our operating model was such that they were all completely independent. So the only reason why they would ever really adopt anything was if it was valuable to them. So that was a major kind of signifier for me of, well, we've done something good here. Linked to that, but slightly separate, was the CEO of Virgin Atlantic was a real character and hadn't always been all that taken with some of the fluffy cultural stuff, despite working for Virgin. And he quoted some of our people promise in a an external press release about the business. And for me, that was like, it doesn't get much better, because he was often, he would come up with the reason why not, rather than why to support that. But then, more importantly, after about 18 months of adoption of this, the turnover of employees within their first 6 to 12 months dropped by 7 percentage points. You know, so that was a significant drop, and one that, again, if you want to argue it either way, I'm sure you could, that it wasn't to do with having a clearly articulated promise, but I feel like it was too much of a coincidence, and it was the major thing that we rolled out across that sort of year, 18 months. So I'm claiming that as and again, another positive impact of the value of doing this work. So yeah, that was a nice legacy to leave, you know, when I eventually left a couple of years later.
And amazingly successful to change the mind of somebody who, the CEO,
Isn't it always?
the opposite.
Yeah, it's a shame, because you always have those advocates and those allies that you work with throughout these kind of programs of activity, and it's brilliant to have them on side, but it's when you convince somebody that's always been a bit skeptical about it that that's the biggest win.
So what results do you typically see when culture is properly invested in? So for teams and for leaders, and also client outcomes as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect, Laura, we may have, I feel like I might be being a bit of a stuck record on this one, because I think it will show up in lots of different ways. One thing that we haven't touched on, though, is that where I've seen it be really valuable is when an organization is growing or undergoing some form of transformation, you know, maybe through acquisition or something like that. Because what having that sort of really clearly aligned brand and culture, and that clarity of, again, who you are, allows you to grow or transform in an authentic way, which means that you are making the right decisions for your business. You are, again, attracting the right talent for your business that is additive to the culture, because often when you're growing, you're desperate to get people in who have the technical qualifications and expertise, but they might not be the right cultural fit, and therefore can slightly derail your progress. So I think actually, when you have got a culture that is working well and is properly invested in, and is very deliberate and purposeful in, you know, maintaining its essence and its authenticity, I think it carries an organization very well through periods of change. So that would be the only other thing to add, I think, in terms of the impact that it can have.
So if someone is listening from a law firm that's never really considered culture strategically, which I imagine there are quite a few, where should they start thinking about it, do you think?
So the first thing to say is every organization has a culture already. Whether you've ever given it any thought or not, it exists. So I would say one of the key starting points is to actually get under the skin of what is the existing culture that is present, and then to reflect on, is that what you'd like it to be? And it might be that actually, it's pretty good, but by paying more attention to it strategically, you can really amplify it and really energize it and get it to work even harder for you. Or it might be that you unearth a few challenges, and a few kind of characteristics that actually aren't aligned with your ethos, with your DNA, and probably need a little bit more deliberate and proactive addressing. So that's the starting place for me, is to actually almost do a bit of an audit around what's currently the reality. And I would say that takes a bit of time to really listen, to really understand it. There will be lots of kind of cues in many different places. There will be anecdotal information, there'll be survey data. Probably most organizations do some survey of some description. There'll be exit interview information. God forbid you might look on Glassdoor, albeit I think that tends to be the place where your most disgruntled people go. But it can hold the mirror up about certain things, maybe that might be a bit of a blind spot. And I would say to anybody that is thinking about looking at their culture more strategically, try very hard to be open-minded as you do this, because it can be easy to feel defensive. I've certainly been there, when I've done this work, when I've been in-house. But try as much as you can to be open-minded about it, really engage with people and listen to their views. And actually, by doing that, it allows you to engage with people to co-create the solution as well. If there are problem areas, to give people a sense of agency and involvement. Because whilst your senior leaders, of course, are instrumental in setting the tone from the top, culture is impacted by everybody in an organization with, every little interaction. So actually kind of syndicating the challenge and putting it out there to everybody in the organization can be incredibly powerful. And it can also set a very clear tone around what you would like the culture to be. So I would say, it's not making decision by committee, but it actually does allow you to get the warts and all reality. But I mean, I often ask questions through this process of, what are we like at our best when we are absolutely humming? Like, what characterizes it? What is happening? And then, on our worst day, what does it look like? What are the things? And sometimes it's an overdone strength, which we might know about from a personality profiling thing. Sometimes it will be totally different. But, I think every culture goes through phases of being in a really brilliant place, and at other times just not quite clicking. And I think recognizing that you can set a clear aspiration about what the culture will be like most of the time. The reality is there will always be off days, or there'll be teams that are going through a slightly harder time or whatever. So understand what you look like at your best and what you look like at your worst, and how might you mitigate some of those things, for me would be definitely the kind of the starting point. And I mean, and I'm not meaning this as a shameless plug, but I know it will come across that way. Sometimes having somebody external help you through some of this is very valuable. As we said, firstly, they can be the sounding board from a process perspective, but secondly, they can actually help keep things in perspective, around what is unique, what's not, what do you hear in every organization, irrespective of sector. I mean, it's come the amount of things that I hear with all of my clients, and it's easier for me to tell the team, actually, you probably don't know how good you've got it. It's much easier for me to say that than the senior team. And genuinely, there will always be something where I'll say, you've got it good here in this, that, and the other. So don't knock it.
Yeah, it's just having that perspective, isn't it, that we really have, yeah, as well. Yeah. So what do you find the most fulfilling part of your work, would you say? And what change would you love to see in how firms approach culture?
I think the stuff that I love doing the most is, I mean, my ambition when I decided to start working freelance was to do interesting work with interesting people. And by and large, I have been able to do that. I love the variety of the different clients that I have. all shapes and sizes, all different sectors. So I'm constantly learning. And as I said, because I work in a very collaborative way, I quickly sort of feel part of the team and get to grips with what's going on in that industry or with that particular business. So it's always a learning curve for me, which is brilliant. And seeing the impact, seeing the kind of the penny drop for a lot of people around, actually, this isn't a nice fluffy thing to do. It actually has hard-hitting kind of commercial impact and just makes work much nicer at the end of the day, actually, for everybody involved. I tend not to do, like, I won't push on a closed door. I'm lucky I do. Clients that I work with see the opportunity, see the potential of doing this work. So it is, I do have to guide them through some of it and convince maybe some of the board members that it's worth the investment. But most of the time, there's a really positive appetite there already. So I'm getting to work with like-minded people. And I think then the thing that I would love to change, and I suspect it's been a theme through what we've already talked about, is don't see culture as something separate. It is absolutely the heart of your business and it is the greatest asset of your business. So it's not another thing to do. It's the beating heart of any organization.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Well, this has been really fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
So where can people find more about you and your work?
So I have a website which is sawbridgeconsulting.co.uk, and I am on LinkedIn quite a lot. So yeah, I'm just Amy Sawbridge on LinkedIn, so you'll be able to find me. I am trying very hard to show up consistently on LinkedIn. There are days where I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with it, but hopefully it gives people a bit of a view of the kind of clients that I work with, and kind of my outlook on the type of work that I do. So I'm sure people will get a good feel for my own brand maybe there.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And yeah, I'm sure this is going to be a fascinating one for our listeners as well. So thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Conscious Podcast. Having an understanding of your firm's purpose and culture is the first step in building a workplace where people genuinely want to stay. If Amy's insights spark something for you, be sure to connect with her on LinkedIn and explore Sawbridge Consulting to learn more about her people-first, values-led approach. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share this episode with someone in your network. See you next time.